May it please the court. Chief Justice Moon, I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I make three primary arguments today. First, neither the United States Constitution nor the Hawaii Constitution requires that the allegations justifying an extended term in this case, that is, that Brian Jess is a multiple or a persistent offender, be alleged in the charging document. But second, that the court should not reach this question because under settled rules governing the retroactive application of new rules of constitutional law, even were this court to establish such a new rule, since Mr. Jess's conviction became final in 2003, the court could not apply such a rule to Mr. Jess. And under the settled doctrine of retroactivity established by the United States Supreme Court in Teague v. Lane and adopted by this court in State v. Garcia, this court should not reach out to decide a case where even if it ruled in favor of Mr. Jess, it could not apply the rule to Mr. Jess.
Have we done that before, Mr. Bennett?
The court has talked about pure retroactivity before in criminal cases. It has talked about it in State v. Garcia and, for example, Your Honor, in a dissent in State v. Kekona, talked about it was a policy that could be applied in certain cases. And the court has said...
Didn't we do that in Tachibana?
I believe the court did, Your Honor. And our third argument...
In other words, we applied a new rule. We established a new rule and applied it purely prospectively.
The court has the authority to do that, Your Honor, but we believe that the better rule is the one stated by the Supreme Court in Teague v. Lane, which is that a court should not reach a question if it cannot even apply it to the person who brought the question to the court. But finally, as the court has said, if the court is going to set aside that prudential rule governing the application of new rules of procedure, we would ask the court to do it on a purely prospective basis only.
Mr. Bennett, hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court said that if the court adopts a new rule, and we implied that, at least in Garcia, that the new rule should be applied to the person in front of the court who might be affected by the rule and to all those cases then pending and not final?
No, I believe that the Supreme Court of the United States, for example, has said the exact opposite. It said that if a person's conviction is final on direct appeal, such that a new rule of constitutional law doesn't fit within the two narrow examples of Teague v. Lane, then it won't even reach the question because it can't apply it to the petitioner. So I believe that the court's...
So if the court... In other words, that the court should apply the new rule to the petitioner?
No, that the court shouldn't decide the question because the petitioner's conviction became final in 2003, and this doesn't fit within the exceptions of Teague v. Lane, so the court should wait
for... How do you define finality?
Final on direct appeal, that's the way, as far as I know, all courts define it.
You're excluding certiorari from that?
No, it includes the period of certiorari once the time for certiorari has expired, so generally 90 days after final judgment on appeal.
So with respect to Mr. Jess, his case is not yet final.
His case is final. His case became final in 2003 with regard to this issue. Mr. Jess did not raise below on direct appeal.
Case is still here on certiorari.
It's here with this court on a reserved question after remand from the United States District Court for the District of Hawaii on a habeas case. So unless the court were going to establish a totally new rule dealing with retroactivity, which as far as I know no court has established, Mr. Jess's conviction is considered final on direct appeal.
Excuse me, Mr. Bennett, the question that we posed in the order requesting supplemental briefs referred to Cunningham v. California, 127 Supreme Court at 864. Were you able to find any language on that page germane to this matter?
No, Your Honor.
Let me quote you something from that page. The six-member majority in Cunningham wrote, citing to United States v. Harris, an earlier post-Apprendi decision of the Supreme Court, quote, Apprendi said that any fact extending the defendant's sentence beyond the maximum authorized by the jury's verdict would have been considered an element of an aggravated crime by those who framed the Bill of Rights. What are the implications of that statement?
The implications of it are, I would respectfully suggest, are none with regard to cases in state court. First of all, every court that has looked at the question has said that federal law does not have any requirement of an indictment. It has no requirement of a grand jury, going back to Hurtado v. California from 1984. Apprendi specifically said in footnote 3 and Ring in footnote 4 that it wasn't deciding whether any of these things needed to be alleged in an indictment. And with one narrow exception, every court that has decided the question, state and federal, has said that there is no federal requirement that this be in an indictment. The federal courts have said it, at least 18 state courts that we've cited in our brief have said it, and the only court that said anything contrary was a New Hampshire Supreme Court, which simply missed the footnote.
The United States Supreme Court has simply not reached the question with respect to state court prosecutions. Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that. I would respectfully say that the Supreme Court has never held that, since the Supreme Court has held definitively that there's no requirement even of a particular type of charging document. There's no requirement of a grand jury. There's no requirement of an indictment. There's no requirement even of a particular information. There's just a requirement that the defendant get notice and an opportunity to be heard.
What's the difference between the federal grand jury clause and its equivalent in the Hawaii Constitution?
Well, in the Hawaii Constitution, it says no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime, and being a persistent or multiple
unless
on a presentment, an indictment, a finding of probable cause after a preliminary hearing or pursuant to information.
So isn't it true that the only difference between the grand jury clause as it appears in the United States Constitution and our equivalent is that federally one must charge by indictment, whereas in Hawaii one has the option of charging by indictment, complaint, or information?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, this type of fact has never been passed upon by the United States Supreme Court as to whether this kind of a fact would need to be in an indictment. For example, that a defendant may in the future be convicted of two crimes. But even if that were the case, this court has said over and over again for 35 years since this, which was part of the Model Penal Code, was put in our statutes, that these types of things should not be in the indictment. You all have told us for 35 years, or at least for 20, don't put these facts in the indictment. As recently as the Keikoiva case of 2007, and I quote,
I'd like to take things one step at a time. You're well aware that in Malgautenga, we got whacked. And not only did we get whacked, but on February 20, 2007, the day that the United States Supreme Court vacated our judgment in Malgautenga and remanded for reconsideration in light of Cunningham v. California, it did the same thing in roughly 200 other cases, most of which were California cases, but we were included, New Mexico was included, and Tennessee was included, and all of these orders said the same thing, roughly translated, look at Cunningham, stupid. And so we're looking at Cunningham. I'm asking you what the, if it is true that any fact extending a defendant's sentence beyond the maximum authorized by the jury's verdict is an element of an aggravated crime, what implications does that, as a matter of federal law, what implications does that have with respect to our established jurisprudence as a matter of state law?
None, Your Honor. There have been 20 state cases that have decided this issue, and except, as I said, the Supreme Court of New Hampshire misreading Apprendi, They have all concluded that there is no requirement in their state constitutions that these types of factors be alleged in the charging document. That somebody is a multiple or a persistent offender isn't a crime. Article 1, Section 10 says you have to be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime. This simply isn't a crime. It doesn't admit of a probable cause finding. In the case of a multiple offender, you couldn't even show probable cause because the person hasn't been convicted yet. Multiple offender says if you're convicted of two crimes in the instant charging document, how could you show probable cause to a grand jury that someone has been convicted of two crimes when they haven't been convicted of two crimes yet? But beyond that, Your Honor, if the court wanted to change its jurisprudence, which it has clearly...
All the prosecution would have to show a grand jury is that there is probable cause to believe that a defendant has committed two crimes.
I disagree, Your Honor. The multiple offender statute requires the conviction. It would be probable cause to believe the person has actually been convicted in the same way that being a felon in possession doesn't require probable cause that a person may be convicted in the future. It's that a person actually is convicted. That's why the legislature has provided that you need notice of this at an appropriate time, and that's why this court has said time and time again that notice is what is required under the Constitution. But even were that not true, Your Honor, what the legislature has provided for in this case still satisfies the Constitution, because Article 1, Section 10 says, or upon information in writing signed by a legal prosecuting officer under conditions and in accordance with procedures that the legislature may provide. That's exactly what happened in this case. There was a motion signed by the prosecutor asking that an extended term be imposed, and that was pursuant to procedures adopted by the legislature. So even if the court were going to establish a new principle that this is somehow an offense when it clearly isn't, and no other courts have done that, this still satisfies the information charging part of the Constitution.
What do you make of this statement from the lead opinion in Harris, 536 U.S. at 567? Read together, McMillan and Apprendi mean that those facts setting the outer limits of a sentence, ellipse, are the elements of the crime for the purposes of constitutional analysis.
I don't believe they're talking about multiple or extended offender status, but even if they were, they are defining federal law. There has never been a court that has held that as a matter of federal law, this needs to be charged in the indictment.
What about this statement from Apprendi, 530 U.S. at 478? Any possible distinction between an element of a felony offense and a sentencing factor was unknown to the practice of criminal indictment as it existed during the years surrounding our nation's founding.
Well, I think, Your Honor, to me what that means is that the founders wouldn't have understood Apprendi jurisprudence at all and probably would have said that the jurisprudence of this court was the jurisprudence that made sense with regard to extrinsic and intrinsic factors. But regardless, the Supreme Court in Apprendi specifically said it was not reaching any type of question about whether it needed to be alleged in a state indictment. And I would respectfully ask the court to look at all of its sister courts, which have rejected this view. And the reason, in part, they've rejected it is because a rule like that provides no benefit to a defendant. How could it possibly benefit a defendant to have a grand jury, for example, in Mr. Jess's case, to hear at the time it's considering whether...
Did we have a grand jury in Mr. Jess's case?
No, but in Mr. Malgatega's case or Mr. Cowa's case or a judge hearing a probable cause hearing...
Isn't it pretty much standard practice now to charge by complaint?
There are a great many cases that go to a grand jury, but it's still a judge has to make a probable cause finding. Why would you want a judge hearing that, or a grand jury hearing, that the individual has 20 prior convictions and that he's likely to pose a danger to the community such that he needs an extended term of incarceration?
Mr. Bennett, getting back again to this idea of finality, Mr. Jess did run his review through the courts, the state courts, but the federal court set aside that judgment, didn't it?
Federal court set aside the sentence and remanded
right,
for the imposition
of a new
sentence.
Vacated the judgment and remanded. so that in effect, Mr. Justice's case is still within the system and we're back where we were in terms of the appropriate sentence to be given him.
Your Honor, as far as I'm aware, there is no court that has ever viewed retroactivity in the way that you've stated it. When Mr. Jess was convicted in 2000, the rule was extrinsic facts did not need to be in the charging document. He never raised that claim on direct or collateral appeal that it had to be in a charging document. Every case that I'm aware of considers Mr. Jess's conviction final for purposes of retroactivity analysis, such that if the court adopted it.
Well, the retroactivity analysis didn't take into consideration the fact that the judgment was set aside because it was initially unconstitutional.
Your Honor, the same situation presented this court in Gomes, where it had to decide whether to apply Apprendi retroactivity. Retroactivity.
I didn't agree in Gomes,
the court didn't, and no other court that I know of has applied Apprendi retroactively. Mr. Jess's conviction is considered final under any analysis of retroactivity of which I am aware. And if this
what about Magotuega? Excuse me. Mr. Jess is sentenced under the same statute as Magotuega. Is that correct? So when you brought this reserve question up to the court, it was with respect to the sentence that was in effect pre-Magotuega.
There was a reserved question that came to the court at the time before Act 1 was passed.
And, now right, and before Magotuega, too.
Yes. And so,
your position in this reserve on this reserve question that was that the court should send the case back and have a jury impaneled.
That was our position, Your Honor.
Okay. But post Magotuega 2, this court said, the majority said you couldn't do that.
And that's why the legislature...
And remanded Magotuega 2 for purposes of non-extended sentencing. Well, is that right?
I'm not sure that's exactly what the court said.
Well, that's what the court said. Just read it. But non-extended sentencing.
But in any case, that was pre-Act 1, Your Honor. And
I'm not talking about pre-Act 1. I'm talking about Magotuega 2. So that if Magotuega 2 says that you remand for non-extended term sentencing and Jess was pending at that time, shouldn't Jess be treated the same way?
I would say two things. First of all, in Magotuega 2, if Mr. Magotuega has not yet been sentenced, I would say Act 1 applies to him and he could be sentenced under the procedures of Act 1. But
we don't have Act 1 before us or Magotuega on remand. That still has to run its course, right?
Well, Your Honor, Act 1 exists. As you and Justice Duffy said in your order dissenting from the motion to remand, Act 1 is a fact. Act 1 exists.
Act 1 exists, but it doesn't exist in terms of necessarily this court's decision on this specific case.
Well, I can't understand why it wouldn't. It's an act of the legislature. The legislature has said it applies to all cases pending resent.
Well, I think precisely because what Judge Seabright pointed out, that even if this case is remanded, we don't know what will happen. So we don't know ultimately what the effect of the sentence would be and whether or not Act 1 would be involved. You know, Judge Seabright said he didn't think that a jury would convict or would find that Mr. Jess would be subject to an extended sentence. So even if this were given to a jury and the jury rejected the extended sentence option, then Act 1 would never be an issue.
Well, Your Honor, the court has the reserved question before it. The court has obviously decided it's going to answer the reserved question. And since Act 1 by its own terms applies to Mr. Jess, either, in our view, the answer to the reserve question should be yes, because by its terms the answer is yes, a jury can sentence Mr. Jess, or the answer should be we're going to dismiss this matter and not answer the question and let the circuit court deal with this issue as it may, and if an extended term is imposed and Mr. Jess appeals, it'll come back before us.
Mr. Bennett, everyone agrees, do we not, that the effect of the United States Supreme Court's action in Malgautenga was to make it abundantly clear that we were wrong with respect to the need or the requirement that the necessity finding go to a jury.
Yes.
We're all agreed.
Yes.
All right. I'm quoting now from our decision in State v. Kawa. Oh, by the way, I noticed that in your supplemental brief, you did not cite to State v. Estrada or State v. Appaud. Did you not think that those decisions had any relevance?
Well, I think that both decisions have relevance, Your Honor, but we didn't have a lot of time to deal with a very complex issue.
Let me quote to you from Kawa. The Apprendi Court held that findings that implicated elemental facts requisite to imposing an enhanced sentence must be charged in the indictment. And then we cited to Estrada as being in accord, Estrada relying on Appau, quote, in holding that aggravating circumstances which, if proved, would result in the application of enhanced sentencing must be alleged in the indictment. What do you make of that?
Your Honor, this exact issue was before this court in Cala, where the defendant actually claimed that it violated his constitutional rights, that the extrinsic facts were not.
Well, it turns out that we were wrong in Cala with respect to the necessity finding.
Only as to whether the jury would need to make that finding or not. The court decided this exact question in Cala and specifically said these shouldn't be in the indictment. And as I said, as recently as 2000.
The necessity of an extended term of imprisonment for the protection of the public an aggravating circumstance which, if proved, would result in the application of an enhanced sentence?
It's directly contrary to the holding of every case that this court has had on this subject, where the court has said correctly that these are extrinsic to the crime itself. They have nothing to do with the crime. And the legislature has determined that these ought to be, as this court did, in a separate proceeding based on notice. This defendant has demonstrated no possibility of prejudice from the fact that this wasn't in the indictment. And, Your Honor, my final point on this issue is we in this state relied on this court over and over again, this court telling us these should not be in the indictment. If we had put these facts in the indictment under the cases you've just talked about, Appau and his predecessor, Joa, if we had put these in the indictment, taken it to a grand jury or a judge, you would have told us we have disregarded your rule about extrinsic and intrinsic, we had prejudiced a grand jury, and you certainly would have reversed any conviction that resulted from a grand jury in which we had put in evidence of the defendant's prior record or his dangerousness to the community. We relied on what this court did. If this court got it wrong, and this court is going to say now, not as a result of the Supreme Court, but if this court is going to say, we got it wrong, we change our mind, please don't punish the people of the state of Hawaii for that. If you're going to say, we got it wrong, and so these couple of hundred guys who got extended terms, now we have to look at a new rule, make it purely prospective only. All we did in law enforcement was exactly what you have told us to do for 35 years. Putting this in the indictment won't help any defendant. It'll pollute the grand jury process, it'll waste time, and it'll provide a defendant no additional benefit.
By the way, if the necessity finding is an element of an aggravated crime, that is to say, a burglar as to whom an extended term of imprisonment is necessary for the protection of the public, doesn't that make burglary and UCPV included offenses of the aggravated crime?
Your Honor, I can't understand why the court would want to adopt such a Rube Goldberg type of construct when none of its fellows have. Just last week, the ICA decided that on this same issue, that this wasn't, in the Kutzinger case, that this wasn't required to be put in an indictment. The easy answer to your question is, don't go down that route.
It's a prospective matter. Prospective. Are you willing to gamble that the necessity finding is not an element of an aggravated crime?
Your Honor, I'm going to obviously, like every other prosecutor in the state, look at what your opinion in this case says. But it just makes no sense. It makes no sense to require prosecutors to put this information in an indictment, to put in an indictment with regard, for example, to Mr. Jess, that he is going to be convicted of two offenses and his incarceration is necessary for the protection of the public.
It'd be easy to put it in a complaint, wouldn't it?
We could do it, but the legislature, who you deferred to in Maugautega, the legislature determined that it is a better system to provide notice to a defendant within 30 days of when he's indicted going forward.
Is that incompatible?
Well, it means that it's not in the charging document. It's not part of a crime.
Act 1 is a sentencing statute. It's not a charging statute, is it?
Well, the legislature specifically said in Act 1 that going forward, the prosecutor has to provide notice within 30 days of the arraignment unless good cause is shown and the time is extended. Why shouldn't that be a legislative judgment, especially given this court's solid history of jurisprudence on this issue going back decades?
Does anyone have any quarrel with that legislative judgment?
Yes, if you're going to say it has to be in the charging document, then
the Act 1 would simply afford the prosecution the opportunity to change its mind as to what offense it was ultimately seeking to establish and what sentence it wanted.
Your Honor, I think at base here, again, I can't help but go back to virtually every other state court that has looked at this rule. 18 or 19 out of 20 has rejected any state or federal requirement that it be in an indictment, including the ICA.
Which of those states have a POW Estrada jurisprudence?
I think that in terms of extrinsic, intrinsic, using those words, this court might have been unique. But many courts, as you've pointed out, tried different approaches, all of which were reversed by the Supreme Court.
I'm not talking about intrinsic, extrinsic. I'm talking about the POW Estrada proposition. That aggravators have to be alleged in the charging instrument.
Well, it was aggravators that deal with the crime itself. And if you look at all of the cases that we've cited.
Well, the POW and Estrada, in their four corners, didn't focus on the intrinsic, extrinsic distinction.
But
we teased that out of our prior case law in light of Hulsman in State v. Schrader.
In State v. Schrader, where again the court said don't put it in the charging document, as Justice Nakayama pointed out in Keikuiva as recently as last July. But all of these state cases deal with this essential issue when they're looking at whether it belongs in the charging document or not, whether they use the term extrinsic or intrinsic, aggravating or not aggravating. What they look at, and I would cite to one particular statement in Poole from Alabama, 846 Southern 2nd 370, the Alabama legislature did not intend to create new offenses. It intended instead to provide harsher penalties. That's what, since 1972, our statute has been about. That's what this court has recognized for 35 years with regard to these historic extrinsic factors. There is no need for our state on this issue to be a total outlier from the rest of the country when there is no possible policy justification for it, and it will provide no benefit
to any
defendant.
Excuse me. If this requirement that the aggravating circumstances be alleged in the charging document were adopted, you indicate in your briefs that that would be render parts of Act 1 unconstitutional, either retrospectively or prospectively. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard for me to see how the court could rule that it has to be in the charging document as opposed to a notice given separately from that as a matter of constitutional law.
I'm speaking about the specific provision that says a defendant previously sentenced to an extended term under a prior version of this chapter shall be deemed to have received notice of an intention to seek an extended term of imprisonment. So if that is, because of the term shall, mean that that is the way in which notice is to be given, then if this court adopts a rule that says constitutionally the notice must be given in the charging document, that would be inconsistent with what the statute sets out.
Yes.
And that's your position?
Yes.
Okay. Going back to...
Isn't there a difference between notice and the imperative that an element be alleged in the charging instrument, whether the defendant has notice or not?
Well, that is the position this court previously took with regard to intrinsic factors, where the court required them to be in the charging document. But the basic answer to that is being a persistent offender isn't a crime. It's never been a crime. The legislature never looked at it as a crime. The fact that Mr. Jess needs to be in jail for an extended period of time in order to protect the public isn't a crime. It isn't what our framers had in mind as a crime, and that's what our Constitution says, a capital or otherwise infamous crime. And quite simply, being a persistent or a multiple offender just isn't a crime. So there's no reason why that ought to be alleged in the charging document, whereas killing someone who you know is a witness or assaulting someone who you know is a witness, the fact that they're a witness is part of the crime.
So you would read Apprendi as focusing on the term element as something that simply has to be proven to the jury?
Apprendi, in my view, had nothing to do with whether it was an element of the crime or not. Apprendi stood for the proposition that a fact which is necessary to the imposition of a sentence has to be found by a jury.
So you agree with what I just said?
Apprendi, I believe Apprendi had nothing to do with whether something's an element of an offense or
not. We all agree Act 1 exists, but Act 1 has not yet been applied in this case. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And so the fact that the ICA said, well, the prosecutor says they will proceed under Act 1 doesn't necessarily mean that Act 1 will become an issue in the case, does it?
We're going to seek an extended term for
I know you want to come under Kunsinger, but I'm saying that the fact that the ICA said the prosecution is going to proceed under Act 1 doesn't necessarily mean that Act 1 will ultimately become an issue in that case.
Well, if we seek an extended term, it will be an issue. It doesn't necessarily
mean... Well, it won't become an issue if, for example, and I'm talking about possibilities, there's a plea bargain, there may be a hung jury, there may be a rejection by the jury of an extended term. All of those things could happen. We don't know, do we?
Well, we don't know that a jury will find that an extended term is necessary, but Act 1 is implicated by seeking an extended term.
I think Act 1 says the prosecution can request that you proceed under Act 1. So at least technically there's another part of this equation. The court has to agree with that request.
Act 1 says the court shall initiate that proceeding at the request.
I thought Act 1 says the court may. Either the prosecution or the court may.
Act 1 says the court may impose the sentence or not, even if the jury finds necessary beyond a reasonable doubt. But Act 1 says the court shall initiate these proceedings upon the request of the prosecutor.
So the fact is that that hasn't happened in this case.
It has not happened.
So Act 1 is not yet in front of us with respect to the specific facts of this case?
Well, Your Honor, it strikes me as semantics. Act 1 is in front of you if you want
There are possibilities that in this case, Act 1 may not be a crucial issue once the case is remanded.
Well, Your Honor, if your order said you have to sentence Mr. Jess to a non-extended term no matter what in this case, then you would have, whether explicitly or sub silentio, rejected the possibility that he could be resentenced under Act One. If the court simply said, we're not going to reach the reserved question because the facts have changed, and it's remanded to the circuit court for proceedings that the circuit court views are appropriate, then the court could avoid dealing with the
Act One issue. Which I guess brings me back to my original point that to be fair to all defendants who are in the same situation, and Mr. Jess is essentially in the same situation as Mr. Magatuega, shouldn't Mr. Jess be treated the same way as Mr. Magatuega? I think I know that your answer, but I pose that as, to me, a real issue.
Well, again, Your Honor, and I know my time has expired, but again, what I would say is only if this court were going to write a new principle of retroactivity, never, to my knowledge, adopted by any court, anywhere, federal or state, would the analysis be that. And, of course, the court is free to do that. There are courts that have applied a purely prospective rule, like the Fortin Court in New Jersey, on this issue. So the court could do that. But for the court to do what you've said, I'm not aware of any court anywhere, federal or state, which has ever adopted a retroactivity analysis like that one.
Well, can you think of any case where the case has run its course through the state system, but then the federal court reverses the state on constitutional grounds and sends it back to the state courts? And that question has been decided.
As a technical matter, Your Honor, that isn't what happened here. This case did not go to the United States Supreme Court.
If I said the United States Supreme Court, I apologize.
As a technical matter, Judge Seabright didn't reverse the decision of this court.
He vacated the decision.
He as a technical matter, Your Honor, all Judge Seabright did was vacate the sentence pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2254.
Yeah. Of course. That's why he went to the federal district court. Right.
But technically, Judge Seabright has no authority to review decisions of this court and didn't do so in this case.
That's true, but by implication, he, in effect, ordered the state court to follow the Ninth Circuit's decision in Apprendi.
He did do that.
With respect to applying Apprendi.
He did do that, Your Honor.
The fact that your time has expired obviously isn't your fault. Assuming a lot of time with questions from the bench, but the fact is we live in a post-Cunningham world, whether we like it or not. Isn't it possible that Apprendi and its progeny, including Cunningham, have unintended consequences on the application of state law?
I would respectfully say no, Your Honor. Apprendi is now 7 years old. Admittedly, Cunningham is only 1 year old, and there were states like California with the determinate sentencing law that tried to test the limits of Apprendi and that it didn't work. But on this issue, there has been 8 years of jurisprudence, and there has been no one except for this New Hampshire court, which just got it wrong.
That's why I asked you earlier whether, to your knowledge, any of the state jurisdictions that you cited have a POW Estrada jurisprudence, and I rather suspect that you don't know. I don't know. I haven't researched all of them, but I rather doubt that most, if any, of them do.
Well, Your Honor, I have read every one of those state cases, and what I can tell you is that in the vast majority of them, they go through this same structural analysis. So while they may not use the words of a POW at Estrada, they go through the same type of analysis because so many of them did it in a way very similar to the way this court did. But the fact that the United States Supreme Court has taken the view it has of the Sixth Amendment is no reason for this court to impose upon Hawaii a system regarding charging, again, that makes absolutely no constitutional sense and no practical sense. There is nobody who wants, other than for the fact that it may set a few defendants free, there is no reason that makes any sense at all to require this to be in the charging document.
Justice Kennedy, joined by Justice Breyer, in Cunningham, argued for the intrinsic-extrinsic distinction, and the majority rejected it out of hand in a single sentence.
I'm aware of that, Your Honor. Hawaii, we wrote the state's amicus brief in Cunningham supporting California. We are we're very familiar with the issue, but there is simply because the United States Supreme Court went down this path on the Sixth Amendment is no reason for this court as a matter of state law, because all it is state law. If this court decided as a matter of federal constitutional law that this had to be in the charging document, the Supreme Court would, in my view, grant cert and take that case. But there's no reason for the court to do it as a matter of state law. Our Constitution doesn't require it. This court's reasoning in all of these cases going back 20 years was sound, but at its base, being a persistent or multiple offender isn't a crime, and that's why it needn't be alleged in the charging document. Thank you.
Aloha and good morning. Mr. Jess has suffered great prejudice because the factor that was primarily used to augment his sentence was an intrinsic fact, the use of the knife. But he didn't know that when he confronted the witnesses against him, including the cab driver himself. He had no knowledge that after the fact he would need to or had a post need to develop that kind of evidence when he was on trial. So
the dangerous instrument that he used was not a knife?
That he used the knife in such a way to demonstrate that his continued extensive incarceration was required. The prosecution relied extensively on the knife in addition to petty misdemeanors and misdemeanors. But the fact that he had escalated his criminal conduct from nonviolent conduct to one that at least had the potential for violence, possession of a knife, even though it was waived, it was not touched to the victim. But all that didn't make it into the record because he didn't know at the time he went to trial that that was going to be an issue. All the cases cited by Mr. Bennett, particularly in other states, are cases that can be clearly distinguished on grounds that they were purely cases where the person had received adequate notice by other means, and it was harmless error. So the case, in many of those, they didn't even reach the issue of whether it should be an indictment or not because it was harmless error. In our case, we have an intrinsic fact which under Estrada was required to be alleged in the complaint, and it was not. Had it been, we would have no concerns that this would involve simply retaliation from a prosecutor against the defendant for exercising his right to go to trial, which is what we believe happened in this case. We don't believe that Act One will ever be found constitutional. Simply because a fact qualifies as what the ICA labeled a necessity finding in Kunstiger, therefore bringing Apprendi into play doesn't automatically mean that that same factor, the future dangerousness, is specific enough to give to a jury. It raises the Furman problem. You don't have any reason to expose the jury to this total untrammeled discretion to determine which person should serve life and which person should only serve 20 years.
Well, if Cunningham v. California is not clear about some things, isn't it crystal clear, I mean, in light of its invocation by the Supremes in vacating Maugautenga and remanding it to us for reconsideration in light of Cunningham, that the necessity finding is supposed to go to the jury?
That's right, absolutely. But that doesn't automatically mean that the legislature, because our state is one of the few, I only find one other state that had a statute like we have where there's no specific facts that need to be proven. It's simply a conclusion that needs to be proven. Now, Cunningham determined that that was essentially a fact that required an Apprendi jury hearing. But if you look at how the other states have responded to Apprendi, they were much more creative. They didn't simply try to duct tape a jury trial right onto an existing statute. They looked at whether they might better serve their sentencing procedures by totally changing the way those procedures operated to make them more Apprendi compliant.
Mr. Betancourt, even before we get to that issue, Act One is not before this court.
No, it is not. I don't believe this
court has jurisdiction. It was never applied in this case. Is that correct?
No, it has not been, and I expect it will not in the future be applied.
And we don't even know if on remand that Act 1 will become an issue. Is that true?
That's correct.
I think Judge Seabright threw out the possibility, because he thought it wasn't enough for an extended term, that a jury could reject an extended term.
That's what we think that's very accurate.
So that in the absence of any specific facts with respect to this case, with respect to Mr. Jess, and the possibility that Act 1 may not be a crucial or ultimate issue on his resentencing, should this court deal with whether or not Act 1 is constitutional or not?
No, it should not.
And why not?
Caveat to that, though, I think the court can clearly deal with the notice provision of Act 1 and determine that that is an ex post facto law because it takes away substantive rights that Mr. Jess has, for example, to file his Estrada motion claiming lack of notice in the indictment. It takes away various substantive rights that he has, the right of allocution, to make an unsworn allocution to the trier of fact at sentencing before sentence is imposed. I think that you can determine that that one section of Act 1 is ex post facto as applied to Mr. Jeff.
If this court were to adopt a rule that the aggravating factors relating to an extended term must be alleged in the charging document, that would benefit your client, would it not?
Yes, it would.
But if this court said that that rule applies only prospectively and therefore not to your client, or to persons who, like your client, presently have their challenges to extended terms pending on appeal, what is your position on that?
My position is we did not want to come to this court. We were brought to this court involuntarily by this reserve question. And therefore, that impacts whether or not we have retroactive application under these federal statutes. It's our contention that they brought us to this court, and they have to accept whatever ruling comes out of this court on a retroactive basis, because they're the ones that requested review. It was not Mr. Jess that came up here trying to get a ruling that would apply retroactively. So I think they've waived whatever claim they have to say this cannot apply to Mr. Jess simply by requesting the review that we're getting right now.
You make the point that the prosecution, whether true or not, but you make the point that they brought the reserve question in order to buy time so that they could go to the legislature and get a new act adopted, and that your client this case was simply used as a vehicle to bring this issue before the court.
I did, and I made that based primarily on the fact that he's not exactly a poster child for extended term, as Judge Seabright clearly recognized.
So that, in effect, what you say would seem to have some basis if the rule were not applied to your client, the rule saying that enhanced facts must be alleged in a charging document. Sorry. If this court says that the rule that facts which would indicate that an extended term is sought must be charged, must be alleged in the charging document, but makes that rule apply only prospectively and not apply, therefore, to your client, then, in effect, that does make this case only a vehicle within which to announce a general rule.
That's right.
Is that just as far as your client is concerned?
No, he would then have to rely upon the intrinsic argument about the knife as his sole grounds to claim that it should have been alleged in the indictment, or refer to paragraph 19 of Malga Atega.
Mr. Betancourt, extending on Justice Acova's line of questions, if we were to hold that extrinsic aggravators must be alleged in the charging instrument, that would clearly be a new rule, would it not?
Yes.
Act One is relevant to the ongoing vitality of or viability of our Mao-Gautenga analysis, is it not? In other words, in Mao-Gautenga, we look to the clearest, unambiguous expression of legislative intent with respect to whether extrinsic enhancers should be tried to a jury. The statute then in effect, Act 230, went out of its way to insist that the sentencing court retain the prerogative to make those findings, not a jury. Now we have Act One. That's a different expression of legislative intent. So at least for purposes of the Mao-Gautenga analysis, that changes the name of the game somewhat, does it not?
It does. The problem is that the legislature should have taken a deeper look rather than simply responding to Mao-Gautenga by tacking on a jury trial. It should have looked to see whether what these other states have done and whether it should really adopt sentencing aggravating facts to be proved or disproved rather than a conclusion from a whole galaxy of facts such as the dangerousness issue, what has been labeled the necessity finding. I don't believe that a necessity finding that requires a jury hearing under Apprendi can be equated with a sentencing aggravated factor. And if you look at the other states, they clearly recognize that in this new era, this brave new world of sentencing by juries, essentially, the populist sentencing is the way one law referred, Larvie-Arco referred to it, that they may need to look and totally redraft the sentencing provisions in order to comply with the due process requirement. The naming of the information in the indictment or the charging document can be decided on a due process issue and not simply a contents of the charging document. It can be a specificity in a notice issue. Our argument is that it's required to be in that document based on the old Hawaii cases that say, on Wells particularly, that you have to notify the defendant of all the elements of the offense and what he needs to defend against. And the second prong of that
as a matter of due process.
As a matter of due process, right. Not as a matter of indictment or charging law, but as a matter of due process, notice, and opportunity to defend law. And that's what is the double whammy here. So even if all these federal cases, particularly Apprendi mentioned Jones and had that quote in Jones, which had then limited later on in the opinion. But it did have, I think it's footnote 3, where it says this applies to this case. So it did not require, at least I don't read that paragraph, as stating that federal law requires that states use indictments, but when they do use charging documents, that those documents have to provide adequate notice. And that's the way I read Apprendi. And subsequent federal cases don't reach that issue. The only one cited, the Sixth Circuit decision cited by the government in its brief, if you look at the cases cited in that, it's clear that they all agreed that if you use an indictment as a method of charging, if a state chooses to do that on its own as a matter of state law, then it still has to comply with certain fairness requirements under the Due Process Clause.
And you're making those arguments, I take it, only on behalf of your client. Well, essentially on behalf of your client. So that those arguments would really have no benefit to your client if that rule were made prospective only.
It wouldn't.
You're familiar with what the United States Supreme Court said in Griffith that a new rule for the conduct of criminal prosecutions is to be applied retroactively to all cases, state or federal, pending on direct review or not yet final, with no exception. You agree with that position?
I agree. And we're not there, final in this case.
Yeah, the Attorney General tried to make the distinction that, well, your case has run through the state process.
Not it's to be run through the there without a sentence.
Okay. He made that point, and he's saying, well, your case has, in effect, been final. So that kind of rule would not apply to you, despite the fact that the sentence was vacated and the case sent back to the circuit court. What's your response to his argument?
You don't have a sentence pending in this case, and so the state, what the Judge Seabright did was remand this for resentencing.
So in effect,
until that takes place, it's not final. That's our position, and I think that is a rational position. Some of these new cases, particularly where you have a state that we have had where it's continually rejected the Apprendi rule over a period of years, you can have a large volume of people who expect eventually that the Apprendi is going to get accepted by the state court. It only happened after Cunningham. But that there might be a special rule of retroactivity that has to be created to take care of that situation where it wasn't their fault that the rule was not adopted in a timely manner so it would affect their case. It was a battle.
Right, and because Act 1 doesn't apply, or hasn't been applied in this case, aren't you in the same position as Mr. Magatuega in Magatuega 2? In other words, that's what you asked for, that the case, based on the reserve question, be remanded to the circuit court for, you say, non-enhanced. Magatuega 2 said non-extended term sentence.
But it didn't say that. It just remanded for sentencing consistent with this opinion.
The first paragraph in Magatuega 2 says the case is sent back for non-extended term sentencing. And you say in your brief, you're asking for remand on non-enhanced sentencing.
Because...
And by non-enhanced, you mean the same thing as non-extended.
Right. Primarily because...
Isn't it clear from Mao Gautenga 2 that Mao Gautenga was sent back to the circuit court for non-enhanced sentencing precisely because Act 1 had not yet been?
Well, I think the court could contemplate that they were going to race to get Act 1 passes.
Well, Act 1 had not been
passed. Right, hadn't been.
Because Act 1 was in response to Magatuega 2.
Right.
What I'm asking or suggesting is this, that I think Mao Gautenga 2 makes it very clear that the defendant was not eligible for enhanced sentencing under an unconstitutional statute. Particularly because the legislature had clearly expressed its intent most recently that the fact-finding with respect to extrinsic aggravators was to continue to be made by the sentencing court and not a jury. That's why we remanded that matter to the circuit court for non-enhanced sentencing. Your client is in a somewhat different position, is he not? Even if your theory is correct, that the reason he's in a different position is because the prosecution bought time by virtue of requesting an answer to the reserved question to go to the legislature and get Act 1 passed.
But I think we are slightly different, but I think we're in the same position because I read Magatuega 2 is also ruling based on the 99 years of precedent going back to In re Atchley in 1909, the territorial court, that when an act is one unitary act and it's declared unconstitutional on its face, that it is void for all purposes. You cannot separate it out. And Maugatega remanded because there was no possible application of that statute that existed. There was no valid statute at the time he was charged in this, and even if Act 1 was passed, it could not apply retroactively to change that. I disagree with relying upon a federal United States Supreme Court case talking about ex post facto to decide when a state court decision that a statute is unconstitutional is on its face is completely voids the statute or not. Daubert chose to find that it did not completely void the statute, and he came up with this argument that he was on notice that the statute, because it was still on the books. You know, we still have a statute on the books in this state that allows a clerk of a court to sign a prejudgment garnishment order, but it's not used.
At least as of this moment, the question whether Act 1 may be applied retroactively is an open question that has not been decided either by this court or the Intermediate Court of Appeals. Isn't that so?
That's true. But I'm contemplating that the court's going to grant cert in Maugatega very quickly, and that we'll have that issue.
In Kutzinger, the ICA said there was no ex post facto problem. That's why it said you can proceed under Act 1.
I think their analysis was faulty in that regard. I think they failed to look at the real world, and this is why it was an advisory opinion.
What you said in terms of the whole statute, 662 being void, because this, well, at least the majority said, on its face, 662 was invalid.
Right.
Means that as far as your client is concerned, because he was sentenced under that version of 662, your client should not, under the precedent of Maugatega, or cannot, if we follow precedent, be subject to a non-extended term sentence.
A non-extended term?
I'm saying to an extended term sentence.
Yeah, it cannot be.
Okay. You know, in Maugatega 2, the majority said, well, we anticipate that a reform statute would be passed, and that reform statute would say that the requirement that the aggravating facts be in the charging document would be part of that statute, so that in effect that statement advised the legislature and the prosecutors on how to enact a valid constitutional statute. You agree?
That's right. Agree. I think it went
and
further.
Did the legislature or the prosecutors advocate that?
I don't believe they did.
They
did not catch all of the hearings, but
it was not in the statute.
It's not in the statute. I'm not sure it even made it into any of the hearings.
Okay. So in effect, what this court had said, or at least the majority had said, the dissent did not reach that issue, was that that's the way you make it constitutional. And the legislature didn't decide to do that. Is that correct?
Right.
So that if we were on our own to reform the statute because the legislature failed to do it, what does that say about the decision-making process of this court?
I don't know if this court has the power simply because the legislature failed to act properly. I think this court gave a warning in additional quotation. The quotation in Maugatega from the dissenting opinion of Justice Kennedy, who recognized the difficulty of having jury determinations on these kind of amorphous dangerousness facts, I think that quoting that in Maugatega was a very clear warning to the legislature that they might want to start from scratch on drafting the statute.
And the legislature
not even begin to do that.
The legislature and maybe the prosecution didn't take note of that. So doesn't that mean that, at least as far as this court is concerned, that we really should be deciding the specific case before us and not try to be forecasting the future. And then whatever other branches of government tend to do is really within their province. That what we have to decide is the case before us and the specific facts of the case before us.
Well, that's been my contention to this court for years, that it cannot engage in trying to correct for legislative deficiencies and in the procedures of the legislature. I think the legislature's been badly guided, though, by their legal advisors. I think that this issue has been brewing for years, and they've had passed up many opportunities to look at this issue. Even if the state Supreme Court was right in all these decisions up to the time of Maugatega, that maybe there was a better way to get these things done. And I think that's where the legislature missed the ball. And so they're constantly doing these things. Act 230, I could not believe that it came out of a Penal Code Review Commission, and they still came up with such a deficient statute after the kind of people. And it was Justice Nakamura who was involved in that, along with Mr. Bennett. I mean, that was just...
Even though the centerpiece of Apprendi...
That was stillborn from the start.
You need a jury trial, and the amendment didn't even refer to a jury
right.
trial.
Nor does it refer to the things that were discussed in the prior cases involving 647. Do you get more than one shot at a jury?
We hinted pretty broadly into FOIA, didn't we? In 1999... Before Apprendi was decided, at least with respect to intrinsic aggravators, that they had to be alleged in the charging instrument and tried to a jury, and the legislature simply ignored it.
When it enacted 647, it ignored that. It's correct. It said the judges decided, so the court had to basically redraft the statute in order to make a jury trial right, rather than simply saying, you got it wrong. I think the power of the court should be to simply tell the legislature when it got it wrong, not to try and correct for it. I think the legislature would have been better looking, go back to Holzman, where Egbert Kidwell was the judge that wrote Holzman, and he clearly pointed out that this statute is on the borderline of giving unbridled, arbitrary, and capricious power to a judge, and so he read, that was only the 662 print 4, I believe. But he clearly pointed out that this kind of sentencing on extended term is an area that lies very close to the due process clause, and you have to, all the death penalty cases were being reversed at that time. Furman was decided in 72, I believe, and many of the states had trouble redrafting their statutes to comply with Furman. So I think
that... Justice Kidwell and Halsman, isn't it true that if it weren't for them, we wouldn't have had to discern an intrinsic-extrinsic distinction in Schrader? Because Appau Estrada would have been the governing rule with respect to all aggravators, wouldn't it?
You still come up with the problems that Mr. Bennett pointed out, that it is some of these aggravators are just not aggravators. They're basically conclusions. The juries are incapable of really deciding. And that's why he didn't really face the issue in Holzman of what would happen if those same statutes were being applied by a jury. In fact, he talks about the experience of judges and the ability, but he was even concerned about unbridled discretion of judges. That's why he read the additional element in the 662 print 4 for that same reason. Try and make the statute less capable of arbitrary abuse. When I worked in Mississippi, they had statutes like this, and they used them very effectively. All the jury had to do was look at the color of the defendant, and they knew when to apply the statute or not. And the statute was so vague that they could get away with it. That's where the extremely atrocious, heinous, and cruel came from. It was a widely used aggravator in the South, and it was one of the reasons that led to Furman, because it was so capable of abuse. And it's been reinterpreted. I mean, many states tried. Florida had one, flunked constitutional muster, then later on passed it because they restricted it under state law. This court's restricted that language under state law to make it comply with due process. But I think that these are real serious problems when you have these kinds of things that can mean one thing to one person and something totally else to somebody else, and you're presenting them to a jury that's going to have total discretion. one thing that Mr. Bennett said that I disagreed with. I think a judge has the discretion under Act 1 to tell the prosecution, no, I'm not going to have a jury trial on your allegation.
Yeah, I think if you look at the statute.
Even if you prove all these facts, I'm still not going to vote.
I think what Act 1 does is empower the sentencing judge to ignore a jury finding that the aggravator is present.
Well, and if he can ignore it post-jury, he can say, I'm going to ignore it pre-jury, because even if you prove those aggravators, I'm not going to give an extended term, so therefore I'm not going to waste the time of a jury.
My recollection is the statute doesn't say that at the request of the prosecution the court shall. It says that the prosecution or the court may initiate an extended term hearing.
I think the judge would wisely exercise that discretion to determine if, maybe even require an offer of proof, if proved, are these factors that would make me impose an extended term or not? And if they're not even close, he has the right not to have that hearing.
In fact, even in your brief, you list a whole multitude of issues that may arise when, if Act 1 is implemented at the trial level. All kinds of things about what you do if there's a hung jury, you know, what's the, how do you give the burden of proof, etc. So all there are all these issues to be resolved in an actual case.
Very uncharted waters, right. One of the other, I'm not going to get into Act 1 at length, but my time's up. I'm not going to get into anything, I guess.
You got 5 minutes, Mr. Bennett.
First, with regard to the issue of this defendant's actual procedural due process rights. This defendant has had the ability throughout this case to claim that he was denied some sort of procedural due process and has never made that claim. But to the extent that that's a cognizable claim, when this case is sent back, the defendant could have the ability to raise that. But we're now talking about a motion that was filed in the summer of 06 and a hearing that, if he is resentenced pursuant to Act 1, won't be held until 18 or 19 months after that. So for the defendant to claim he doesn't have notice and an opportunity to be heard just isn't true. Beyond this claim with regard to no notice of the knife, the indictment charged that he was guilty of armed robbery. He had a knife and he threatened the cab driver while he had the knife. So the claim that he didn't know that the judge could sentence him on the basis of the fact that he used a knife in an armed robbery is just totally inexplicable to me. With regard to the Maugotega footnote 19, the court specifically said it wasn't deciding the issue. The court had the benefit of no briefing on the issue of whether charging documents are required to be in the indictment or not. The court cited the Chauvin case, I think, from Minnesota, which said that what you're dealing with is notice and an opportunity to be heard. And in that case, notice well after the indictment was returned satisfied due process, but the legislature chose to adopt a different route to provide defendants notice doesn't mean that what the legislature did is unconstitutional. And in fact, given what this court said in Schroeder about notice and an opportunity to be heard is what is required, in that case for the imposition of a mandatory minimum sentence, there's just no reason to suppose that what the legislature has adopted here is an unconstitutional procedure.
While we're on the subject of footnote 19, do you read it to suggest to the legislature that a requirement regarding what, as a matter of constitutional law, has to be charged or alleged in a charging instrument should be contained in a reformed sentencing statute?
Well, it certainly dealt with that, obviously, but if the legislature had chosen, for example, to say that all of these aggravators had to be in a charging document, then people whose sentences were going to get vacated couldn't be resentenced because obviously for them it wasn't alleged in a charging document. So the legislature was faced with the significant practical problem of, even if it had decided that that was the best way to go, it would have meant hundreds of people who had received extended terms whose cases were still pending on direct review at the time Apprendi was decided couldn't get those extended terms imposed on them because they didn't have this alleged in the charging document, and I think that's one of the reasons the legislature decided to say that for people who had already been sentenced, the notice that they had received was going to be deemed to be appropriate notice. But for going forward, they decided that 30 days after the indictment, especially given the allowance of this state of information charging, was appropriate. With regard to the ex post facto issue, obviously I don't have a lot of time to deal with that, except to say that this argument about void on its face implicating an ex post facto problem was discussed at length by the ICA in Kutzinger, was specifically rejected by the United States Supreme Court in Daubert. There is no state ex post facto provision in the Constitution, and several of the cases cited in the ICA opinion in particular, I believe it's Pilatus from the state of Washington and Hankerson from Minnesota, deal with this exact issue. The line from the Pilatus case is, but as we have said, the key is whether the defendant had notice of the punishment at the time of the crime, not whether in some metaphysical sense a constitutional statute existed at the time of the crime, which is exactly what the United States Supreme Court said in Daubert, that the fact that the statute is declared unconstitutional is of no significance at all for an ex post facto analysis. And finally, with respect, Justice Acoba's discussion of Griffith and its rule of finality just isn't the law in the federal courts or in the state courts. That this defendant's conviction became final in 2003 for all types of retroactivity analyses. If this were in a federal court, this defendant could not receive the benefit of a new rule, and under Teague, this court wouldn't reach it. And the only way, I believe, consistent with this court's retroactivity jurisprudence could decide this issue would be with a purely prospective rule that would not apply to this defendant. Thank you.
This court will take this matter under advisement.